Hi, and welcome to AMI Today. I'm Dr. Eric Huntington, CEO of AMI, and I'm joined today by my guest, Eric Miller from Econologix Financial Advisors. Eric joined me just a few weeks ago, and we had a great event. We had a lot of great feedback from our discussion. And so I was asked by a lot of our listeners to bring Eric back and talk about some specific topics, and we're going to get into those today. Mainly, we're going to get into some economic forecasts for practice owners. What do things look like right now? And what does the data show? And what does that mean for our future and what we need to be doing? Number two, we're going to talk a little bit about Eric's and Econologix Financial Freedom Summit. He's brought some slides with him from that incredible event that I've attended. And we'll talk a little bit about that and how that applies to your practice. And then also, we're going to talk a little bit about inflation. That was something that several viewers or listeners brought up as a topic that they have interest hearing more about and learning more about. So Eric, welcome back to the show. Looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you, man. That's a lot of stuff to pack into 30 minutes, man. We better rock and roll on this.
Well, let's do it. Let's do it. I think we can. I know our listeners are interested to hear what you have to say. Let's start out with, economic forecasts. I mean, obviously from the practice owner's viewpoint, he or she needs to expand their practice, expand their income, improve their business. That's always a given, but it helps to know what the terrain is.
Totally. I mean, there are economic factors out there. We like to say that your financial condition is really an inside job, though. It really is. I mean, there are external factors, but I think it'd be a good time to just to look at some raw data that's out there right now, and then we can just dissect it and just make sure that your listeners, your clients have a plan of attack on exactly what to do, so they feel like there's something that they actually can do about it. And they're not just sitting there saying, oh, woe is me, this thing is gonna turn out terrible. It's like, no. Let's do something that you can turn this thing around and get on the attack of this.
Yeah.
So I'm just gonna start looking at some data if you're good with that right now. And sure. I guess we can start here with the first thing, which is, GDP, which I think is just an indicator of the production that is occurring, the value of assets or production in an economy. And this chart that we're looking at goes back to 1950, and it just shows the real gross domestic product. And of course, there's been periods of time where it has been negative, right? In 2008, it's the last time it was down negative 8.4%. But look at what happened in the second quarter of 2020. It was down 31.4%. I mean, we've just never seen those numbers before. And obviously because we've never been shut down for that period of time before.
That's right. But, and Eric, just to make sure all of our listeners are in tune to this. So GDP is the value of all products and services made in the economy over a period of time.
Yes. So it kind of represents production. Like, what is that, the value of that production? Obviously, with people not working, without producing products, this is what happens. And you can see that it was, it was at a rate we've never seen before. So it's incredible. I thought that, yeah, when I first saw it, I was like, oh my gosh, look at that. The other thing I think that a lot of people are talking about right now is just all this stimulus money. And, what is that going to do? And how much is that? If you look back in 2019, the total federal spending was $4.45 trillion. I mean, $1 trillion. It just seems like monopoly money right now. And the total tax revenue, what we bought in, was 3.46. And, the coronavirus bill is $2.2 trillion. So you can see, obviously, that this issue with debt is just going to continue to perpetuate, right? Because, yep, there's just no way we're going to bring in enough tax revenue to be able to cover all this.
Now, Eric, wait a minute. Isn't an organization's finances somehow magically different than an individual's finances?
Is an organization's finances?
Yeah. In other words, here we have these federal government going, yeah, into debt tremendously, right? And there, yeah, are all kinds of economic theories and viewpoints that say, well, that's fine.
Yeah. You have to look at what's the debt. I mean, I think a lot of us are under the realization that not all debt is bad, right? That there is something called good debt and bad debt. Good debt is obviously something that's going to create more value, that's going to give tax benefits, and it's going to appreciate in value. That's not what this debt that's being created is actually doing. If that was the case, then I think I would have a bit more of an optimistic view, but that's not what's happening, right? It's for consumption purposes or destructive purposes.
So in other words, this debt by and large is not creating infrastructure necessarily that's going to generate more revenue for the economy in the future.
No, it's going to warfare and welfare, which is just, you know, basic destruction and money that is being given to people that aren't producing. So, I mean, it's like there's not going to be a net benefit, I don't think, to the economy by doing that. Mm-hmm. So it's not good debt, as far as I can tell.
And, you know, I it makes sense to me, Eric. And I know I have read about, you know, this debt to GDP ratio being a key indicator. Mm-hmm. And the number I've seen from some economists, I think the guys maybe even won a Nobel Prize, was when the debt to GDP ratio gets over 90%, it's no longer stimulatory. In other words, when there's only a little bit of debt, when you add, you know, when you stimulate the economy, every dollar that they spend maybe adds $1.50 to the economy. But when the debt to GDP ratio gets over 90%, the debt is so burdensome.
You can't service it.
That you can't service it, and every time you put a dollar in, you get less than a dollar back out. And and last time I checked, depending on the metric you use, we're somewhere between like 108 and 120%. So unfortunately, we're at the point where we're having trouble servicing this debt at this point in time as a country.
Yeah, and again, it goes back to the debt. You know, debt has a very it's very burdensome to somebody personally and, you know, spiritually too. I mean, look what it does to you. It sticks your attention to the past. It makes you feel like you can't fulfill your obligations. It just does a lot of bad things to people if they can't navigate it well. So as long as you understand how to use it correctly, there's nothing wrong with it. It's when, you know, you're using debt to, you know, buy things that you don't really understand, or, you know, just for consumption purposes, that's what it becomes overwhelming and destructive to somebody.
Makes sense.
Unemployment claims was the next piece I was going to go over, which is, again, you know, you start looking historically at these numbers, you know, we haven't seen any of these things before. It looked like back in 2008 was when we peaked in unemployment claims. We got up to almost 25 million in May of 2020. Now, granted, it's come back down to about 11 million. I think there was like 880,000 claims last week, but I mean, you can still see it's really high, you know, comparatively. Now, again, I'm not saying that, you know, you should just pack everything up and oh my gosh, what's going to happen next? But I mean, this is the data that's out there. We have more money being created. We have and we have less production occurring. You know, there's got to be some economic phenomenon that's going to happen at some point in time because of that. You know,
makes sense.
So I think that's what I wanted to make sure that we looked at. And then here's the federal debt as a whole. It was at 20 trillion, and now, you know, it's going to be over $27 trillion. To your point, this is what we just talked about. So it's just accelerating at a pace that I don't think we've ever seen. And I think that's the scary thing about it, is that I just don't know, like, what's the end game. I think I kind of have an idea, but I mean, it's something that people just, they haven't been able to see these kind of numbers before. And it's like, what is the effect that this is going to have?
That's right. Now, I think this is a good time to, you know, just talk a little bit about, you know, one obvious solution, no matter how difficult the environment gets, you know, is just flourishing and prospering, is just, outflowing in terms of marketing and communicating and really pushing your business, you know, to be successful. And, you know, the return on the amount of energy spent may be diminished because of the more difficult environment, but what also happens to your competition in that environment, right?
I mean, right?
This is the point in time where those who are successful over the next decade take on market share from those who can't make it.
Oh, 100%. If you look at those companies that have done some of the things that you teach your clients to do, you know, establish systems, create multiple income streams, you know, understand how to hire well, you know, get your finances in order. I mean, if you can really, you know, just do those simple things that you should have been doing the whole time, you're going to have an enormous advantage over people that haven't done those things, because they're not going to be able to recover, because they're going to have to borrow huge amounts of money. And then some of them are just going to flat out give up, which I've seen a lot happening.
Absolutely. So this is a big shakeout, and you get your weakest players leave the game. We've had many, many, many clients. I'm talking, you know, maybe close to 10 clients of ours in the last 2-3 months who have purchased practices from previous competitors. I don't know how competitive those other practices had been, but, you know, there were other doctors in the area who just, you know, either needed a strong partner or just were ready to sell.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of opportunity. This data can be a little bit scary, but the truth is it's a tremendous opportunity.
Yeah. And look, I mean, if you have reserves, if you have cash, if you're profitable, if you have open credit lines, you know, if you've done all the things kind of leading up to this, these are opportunities where you can attack and just and increase your net worth and your empire, you know, 2-3 tenfold in some cases.
Yeah.
Because you prepared yourself for that. And yes. So I think making sure you establish and keep really good financial habits in, you know, you put your profit, you know, as an automatic expense so that you have reserves and you have liquidity and you can buy these, you know, distressed assets, so to speak, relatively cheap. So yeah. It's an amazing opportunity.
I agree.
Yeah. Can we talk about inflation?
Let's talk about inflation.
Okay. Cause I know everyone has their attention on inflation all the time. Right. So, and it's a scary thing because you see all this money that's being quote unquote created. Now it doesn't necessarily mean that it's being utilized though. Right. And I think that what the definition of inflation, a lot of people just assume that it's like, oh, price is going up. Cause remember when we were kids, like, you know, a Hershey bar was like 25 cents. And now it's like, I don't know, like $4. I haven't bought one in a long time. I listen to my chiropractors. So the idea here is that when there's more money in supply than actual production occurring, then of course that is what inflation is. And then as a result of that, you'll see that prices go up because of that. Deflation would be the exact opposite. But you know, in our economy, it's controlled by central banks. The Federal Reserve creates bank reserves to give liquidity to these banks. And then it's when that money then gets lent out by the banks that creates the velocity of money. That's what would create the inflation. And, you know, to your point, you know, I don't know that the velocity of money has been at a high rate in some cases, like I think you said earlier, it's been shown to be declining in some areas.
I just read an article earlier this week that it peaked in 1997. And it's been dropping ever since. It's less than half of what it was in 1997. And so, you know, just so we can kind of think with this, like what velocity means is, let's say I buy a product or service from you. I give you $100. You turn around and you have to buy gas on the way home from work. You pay, you know, $50 to fill up your tank. And then, you know, you get home. So that 50 of that $100 has now been turned around, right? Mm-hmm. So that's how many times is the money changing hands? And yes. So what we're saying is the money is not changing hands as quickly as it was in 1997, you know, even though all this money is being printed. And, you know, so where does the money go? I mean, one example would be, you know, there was a lot of debt buildup, both on the personal side as well as the government side for the last 3 decades. Well, now it seems like, especially due to the coronavirus, people are realizing that, you know, the future, you know, may hold times when it's difficult economically and that they can't be so burdened by debt. And so a lot of people are paying their debt down. Well, that doesn't help with velocity. That's money that's basically disappearing.
That's right. Taking money,
paying down your debt, which is a good thing personally, but for the economy, it means slower velocity.
It has a negative effect, so to speak. And you know, you got to look too, the people that get access to when this money is created doesn't come to Eric Huntington or Eric Miller's bank account right away. You know, it goes to these big banks, it goes to a lot of these big corporations and bailout. And then as the money, you know, gets the velocity increases, that's when it gets diluted and its value becomes less. But the people that got the access to the money first, of course, they got the biggest benefit for it.
I think that's the full value, if you will, before
that's what I think that's what peeves people off more than anything else.
Yeah, I think that's also, Eric, would you say that's part of what's contributing to the asset bubbles? I mean, we have record level stocks. We have we have the value of real estate outpacing the increase in wages for the last couple of decades. We have, I know that with bonds it's inverse, but bonds are at record low levels. For 30 years they've been dropping, right? So we've got all these bubbles, and I think it has to do with what you just said. The money goes to those bankers, Wall Street types first. And what do they do with it? Well, they don't buy extra toothpaste. They buy assets, right?
That's right. And most people kind of assume that that's the only place that they can put their money that's going to exceed the inflation rate. So, they just pour all their money in 401ks and IRAs and the stock market, because that's the only place that they've seen that amount of money go in. And then you have all these passive funds, all these index funds that are just, there's trillions of dollars going in there, and you're actually creating an index fund bubble. And there really is some, now again, I'm not telling people to go out and sell your index funds or your 401ks or anything like that. I'm just saying you got to start looking and saying, is this really the best place to position my money? Are there better places that I feel have a better story behind it that I can create income from that are, going to give me a bigger benefit than just speculating in an area where these guys do all the management and I take all the risk, which is essentially what the mutual fund casino is like. And that's really what it is, right? Because you have money managers, they charge you a percent and a half or something like that. And then, you take all the risk as an investor. They don't. And I don't, that's not really a, I think there's other ways to do it. As far as trying to beat inflation, which may be going to the next slide right here. So, I know we talked about this, like, what is the best hedge against inflation? What do you do? And, from my point of view, it's always this. You look at people that you admire financially and that are making a lot of money and own a lot of income producing assets, businesses and such. I mean, do you think Warren Buffett really cares if the price of milk goes from $2 a gallon to $6 a gallon? I think he can afford it, right? So you're going to have to make sure that you have, good. But gold and silver, I totally agree. Having a component part of that, it's a store of value. It has been for 5,000 years and it will continue to be. So, owning some of that, commodities, managed futures. But I mean, at the end of the day, it really comes back down to what is it you really do well? Where is your core acumen at and how do you improve that? And that's going to be in your business. That's going to be in your business. And, I think the healthcare industry is an amazing opportunity going forward. People still care about their health, and that's not going to stop. And then making sure that as your business is expanding and growing, that you take 10% of that revenue and you put it into other assets outside of the business, that are producing income, and just rinse and repeat on that, and stay out of really sorrowful debt. And I think that's always going to be the best hedge against inflation, is having multiple income streams and making sure that your business is, the value of it is increasing and you're expanding as much as you can.
That makes total sense to me. I mean, if I look at the best investments I have ever made in my entire life, they were investments I made in my career and in my businesses. Those have paid off, so much more than any place else I've ever put my money. As you said, I've been working with you, for years, and what you've had me do is take a portion of all that income and move it into other places that are more secure generally, right? Than an individual business, so that I could diversify my income and build up my balance sheet. But the focus, and you've always told me this, the focus is your practice. I mean, where else are, when I think of both of my practices that I built and then eventually sold, where else am I gonna, it's almost an infinite return. I mean, I know my energy went into it, but I started with nothing because I started both from scratch. I guess I started with an initial investment of money, but the returns are enormous when I look at what I actually got from the practice while I ran it and then eventually sold them. I mean, it's just, I would be hard pressed to find that kind of return anywhere else.
No, you get the income, and then you get the enterprise value of the business. And then, all the other things that you get from the business too. It's not just about money. I mean, it's, you get the the knowledge of how to run a business. You get the time component, which I think you've done really well. You know, you created a business that can run basically on its own without you having to be there full time. It's the relationship values that you get. It's all those other things too that you also want to invest in and make sure that you're doing inside of your business, so that, you know, you really get the maximum value for it. And
I just want to mention this, because I don't know if I didn't cover it in the intro. You know, you specialize in working with business professionals, and you have a lot of chiropractors you work with, and you have a lot of veterinary doctors you work with. I mean, I know you work with other professionals as well, but that really is sort of a large portion of your client base. And you were telling me the other day that right now, despite the economic environment, that some of these large organizations are coming in and buying up these vet practices for tremendous multiples. We're talking 6, 7, 8 times.
Yeah, you wouldn't think that, you know, the corner vet practice that you see every day that you ride by, you know, with Dr. So-and-so that takes care of your dog, you wouldn't think that the value of some of these businesses would be very much. I got to tell you right now, a practice that has multi-doctors in there is selling for as much as 3 times their revenue. Wow. And that's pretty unheard of for private practice, because usually at the best, you know, it's maybe 1 times. But, you know, right now I'm seeing multiples in that industry right now for really well-run practices. When I say well-run, you know, like 3 or 4 doctors and maybe $2 to $4 million in revenue and, you know, a 20 to 30%, you know, EBITDA. You know, they can sell for up to 8 to 9 times their earnings or higher in some cases. I know it's crazy.
It's tremendous.
I think
kinds of things when an organization looks to purchase, like when we talk about these large companies that are buying up individual practices, where is the value for them? What do they see in terms of value? Is it that they're organized? Is it that, you know, that the owner isn't necessarily in their day to day? Why the value?
Well, look, there's a standard. I mean, let's look at the veterinary industry. I mean, like, if you go to any vet practice, I mean, if you're going to get your dog spay or neuter, it's pretty consistent amongst all different types of veterinarians, right? I mean, and if you go get surgeries or anything like that, there's a standard of services that are very consistent. So they're buying that to that degree as well. There's like a standard procedures and consistencies there. Yes. But I think that again, that's one of the reasons they're doing it. Number two, there's barriers to entry. Like, not everyone can own a vet practice. So obviously you have to be able to recruit, you know, people that know how to do this. And the profit margins are good. It's a cash-based business. So there's that's simple, right? It's not like they have to worry about, you know, insurance reimbursers or anything like that. So that's very attractive. I think the other one is there's very little liability in that area as well. So it just kind of check marks all the boxes for some of these bigger corporations as far as why they would want to, you know, acquire as many of these practices as they possibly can. And then, you know, obviously they'll recapitalize and sell it to a bigger group at some point in time. And then, of course, the cost of goods sold, you know, they can control when you have that much that you can, when you can combine that much and you can buy cost of goods, you know, kind of bulk, you can reduce the expenses that just a one doctor practice couldn't do.
Yes.
So that also is another benefit of doing that. So there's all different kinds of ways that they can minimize the expenses that a normal person would have just, you know, trying to manage the practice themselves.
Makes sense.
Cool. What else should we talk about?
Well, I know you had some slides from your financial freedom summit.
And, yeah.
You know, we could spend an hour on each slide. We won't do that. There's just, they're fantastic. I mean, one of the things, I went to your 2.5-day financial freedom summit several years ago, and it was the first time that I ever had a financial advisor actually give me the hatting and the knowledge to really understand what's behind good behaviors, good advice. And I was able to see, when I saw charts like the one you have on the screen, I was able to see, wow, when I've been successful with money, I was operating in a way that matched towards the top of the screen, the green area on your arrow. And when things didn't work out for me, it was, you know, or it was more of a struggle, it's because I was behaving in ways that were closer to the bottom of the scale. And it's one of these things that it's actually obvious, but nobody ever put it together with me, you know, for me like this. So let's take a look at it.
Yeah. So I think, you know, part of our job is to make sure people have their attention on the right things, because I think it's very easy to get your attention on, oh my gosh, you know, should I buy this stock or that stock, or should I refinance this? You know, and they have their attention on unimportant things. Like, to me, the most important thing, one of the most important things obviously is income. Like, how much money do I need to make every month to live the life that I want to live? And what does that represent? That it represents more freedom to me. And obviously, if I'm not making any income, that's going to represent less freedom to me.
Yes.
And, you know, when we're looking at how much money do I need to make, of course, it has to include like certain components, parts, right? So it would include, you know, the ability to pay for your lifestyle, the ability to create, to have money to create other income streams, and then have discretionary income. So when you're sitting down, people do budgets. I think they're kind of, I'm not going to say they're worthless, but you're just budgeting wrong. Like, you have to create, like, what is the actual amount of money that I need to make, not to just pay for my lifestyle, but to really live the life that I want to live. And I think if you really did that honestly, a lot of people are going to go from like, okay, I thought 250 was really my number, but it's actually 500,000. Oh crap, I got to make more money.
Yes.
Yeah, you do. But now you give that target to the business. What's the business need to create for you that you can create that $500,000? I've done that with so many people, and it may take, you know, a year or two, but I can tell you, like, after you really do that, you know, I go back and I show them their tax returns. I'm like, look, remember when you made 250 and we set a target for 500? 2 years later, look how much you're making right now. And it's, you know, it's pretty close to that number.
You know, it is. I'm so happy that you talked about not sticking to budgets or not liking budgets, because I've had trouble in that area. It's just,
yeah, it's
always been easier to just create more money.
It is. It's just, if you're going to have a budget, just have the right number, you know, I mean, just have a number that includes everything that you actually want to do, and not just, you know, a bare expense of how to get back. You know?
Absolutely. I mean, I've had this discussion with my wife when I'm on the wrong side of the discussion, which isn't often. But when I am on the wrong side of the discussion, when it comes to finances, it's usually because I'm trying to squeeze out things that are, I mean, they're not necessities. I mean, come on. I mean, you know, but they are things that we want in our life that make our life fun and enjoyable. And they're things we don't want to do without. And so really what I need to do is just stop arguing with my wife over, you know, this particular expenditure and just go out and make more money.
Dude, I can just see the enlightenment like right now that's occurring over there. It's amazing, right?
That's 20 years of experience. That's 20 years of working with my wife and coming to that conclusion.
You're doing it right now. Hey, look, so the two more scales that then we can close up. But here's another one that I think a lot of people really need to really pay attention to. How is your money being allocated, and what is it doing for you, right? So, you know, a lot of people don't know the difference between an investment and an expense. And look, anything that you're putting your money towards that's going to create more future net worth for you, obviously, is going to be desired. Now, you know, what is that? That's knowledge and application of basic financial law. So training, right? Executive and technical acumen, speculative investments, investment grade investments, reserves and savings. All these things are going to create more future net worth for you. Anything that's below that line, of course, would be, you know, luxury expenses, interest expenses on debt, taxes, bad investments because you didn't know what the hell you were doing and you just kind of blindly just followed somebody. No, that's going to lead to less future income and net worth. Okay, now look, there are times you need to celebrate and just go blow money because you've reached a target, and you should totally do that, right? So I don't want people just to like hoard their money and not celebrate and not go buy stuff for yourself or enjoy your life. But just the majority of your money should be in going in those places right there.
Yes, that's a good, very good point. I think this scale is discussing your normal operating basis should match this, should match the green areas here.
Yes.
And then there are times, like you said, to celebrate, to reward. That's really what it is. It's a reward for having accomplished something.
Yeah, it's just a gradient scale. You know, I think people think of thrift and they think of cheap. That's not what it means. It's just not wasteful. You know, you're just not wasteful with money. So when you're thrifty, it doesn't mean you're cheap. It just means that you don't waste money on stupid stuff.
Yeah.
And again, I'm all for wasting money on things that, as long as you've hit your other targets and you're not doing it, you're not sacrificing your financial future just because you think you need something right now. And I think that that's the thing that we're trying to impress upon people to, you know, not do stuff like that. I think I have one more slide. This is probably my favorite slide because, you know, a lot of people have, and I know this is a pretty busy slide, so you may not get it right away, but, you know, what is your overall target? Like what is financial freedom to you? And I think that, there are different levels of financial freedom, no doubt about it. And, you know, when we kind of broke it down and I looked at it, I was like, what are these different levels? And I tried to put some numbers next to them. And I'll just go to the worst. I think the worst level you can be in is level 3. And you're looking at that. I know you're looking at that and saying, my God, you're making $400,000 to $1 million a year. Your net worth is 3 to 6 million. You know, you got a couple income streams, but here's the thing. This is the 1%, by the way.
Most of our doctors are in 2 or 3.
I know this is the, and these are the most dangerous levels to be in, right? Because once you get into the 3, this is where you see people stop. This is where they like, you know, I just want to enjoy myself and I don't want to push as hard. And if they just pushed a little harder, bought another practice, you know, expanded a little bit more, just pushed a little bit harder, they can get in that $1 to $3 million category 4. And that would really allow them to expand and really be financially free where they don't have to worry about anything. You know, like when you're in level 3, I mean, one bad stock market, one health issue, one problem with your practice, one bad economy, and it, you know, you're right back down to level 2. So it's, yeah, I just want people to make sure you have the right target that you're shooting for.
That's a really good point about setting targets. I think that there were times in my career where I didn't have the right target set. I had because the target I chose in these instances I'm thinking of, the target I chose was comparing myself to some of my peers. Mm-hmm. When really I should have chosen a much higher target, and I could have ended up at one of these higher levels.
Well, you're on your way now.
That's it.
That was good.
Eric, I absolutely love, you know, the charts that you and Econologics have put together. This was literally probably my favorite part of the Financial Freedom Summit that you guys gave, because I have this binder. It sits on my home office. And I refer to it often because it just helps me think with and apply the data that I learned in that summit.
I want people to know what they're doing before they do it. So not just blindly just do something because, you know, someone tells them to do it. We don't want slaves. Yes. People to think and be able to. I think the most important thing that you get out of it is that you just trust yourself and you have confidence in your own decision-making process and you make good judgments. And when you have correct data, you can make good judgments. Mic drop.
Yes, exactly. Well, Eric, you know, I really appreciate you coming back on. I'm sure that our doctors got, at least a few nuggets there. If not, you know, maybe some changes in ideas or attitudes or future behaviors. And I know that's what you're all about, helping practice owners, you know, to move their financial condition to the next highest and then the next highest level. I really appreciate all the help you've given to me, and that's why I wanted to share your knowledge and expertise with our listeners. Again, your company, if you go ahead and let people know, how could they find out about you?
Yep, they can go to Econologics Financial Advisors, or you can go to wealthforkairos.com, and there's they can download a free financial success guide. So there are two ways that we can do it. You can go to our YouTube channel, and we have something we do every week called Between Two Erics, where we tackle a topic and we talk about, you know, how finances affect practice owners. So we're geared towards practice owners. That's what we do. It's who we work with. And, you know, because we understand how valuable your business is to your household wealth.
Exactly. And just to clarify, Between Two Erics has nothing to do with me. I'd be the third wheel in that group. If you guys know who the other Eric is, because it's not me, you've got to visit Econologics and take a look there. You guys have got some great material. And again, I appreciate you being on, Eric.
Thanks, man.
Okay, great. So that'll be it for AMI today. We look forward to seeing you guys again next week. We'll be right back.
Thank you.